Join I and Garlic as we uncover the hidden marketing stories that shape our world, reveal the latest marketing tactics that will shape your future, and the amazing people that grow organizations, movements, and businesses. Learn to grow your business and shape the world around you. Welcome to the Garlic Marketing Show with I and Garlic. And yes, it's Ian, not Ian. That's marketing too.
On this Garlic Marketing Show, we're going to talk about marketing and the tech and SaaS collapse. We're going to talk about the tech stack debt, the lie of best in class, the biggest problem in tech and SaaS advertising that's going to, could cause the death of your company, the laughable way that big companies are coming up with a positioning statement, the huge value of dumb questions, why it's great to hear people say you're dead wrong, and the cheapest marketing insurance you can buy. I've got Bray Jensen from Agra Insights on. Bray, say hi.
Hey there. Great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And we're, it's going to be an awesome conversation. Super important one. If you're in tech, SaaS, or marketing for them. And he's also going to give access to his exclusive guide to their win-loss program. Show you exactly how to run one to really get sales and marketing working together. All this on the Garlic Marketing Show. But of course, this is brought to you by VideoCaseStory.com. One of the best ways to stay in front of your customers is with your customer stories. Go to videocasestory.com where we can help you collect, craft, and deliver those. And also you can get the book, Video Testimonials That Land the Big Fish. All right, let's get started. And so tell me a little bit about your aggregate insights first, and then we'll get into this because I think it's important.
Yeah, we're a firm that's really solidly devoted to bringing the external into companies, right? There's a lot of conversations that people have internally, and there's a lot of rumors and a lot of conjecture and a lot of pet theories. But from our perspective, companies need to ground all of the things that they do and all the strategies and frankly, the tactics that they pursue based on a reality that only the market can bring. So we work heavily around helping people understand exactly what the market is looking for from them, what they actually value out of all the potential things that you can talk about to try to differentiate yourself, how to build personas that actually are usable and have a real purpose, both for marketing teams as well as sales, as well as a lot of work around win-loss. Why are you getting chosen or why are you not getting chosen in these sales cycles? And it's become increasingly important to companies in the last few years. Because of what you mentioned, there's all of a sudden the pie shrinks, but the number of vendors who are out there fighting and trying to stay alive remains constant. And without some guiding light around the market, it's a very difficult place to find yourself in.
It is. And it's amazing to me because I love software and I love tech. And every day someone's like, it used to be you knew all the tools. You used to know all the SaaS. And there's no way you can know it all. And I'm like, what's the difference between this one? And what's the difference between this one and this one? And all this money's been thrown out at them. And I want to know. I love this stuff. And I still am like, I don't really understand what you're doing. And I think there used to be like a time where you could get away with it. And I think it's happening. So is there really a tech collapse or is it just consolidation? What are you seeing?
I think that there's a couple of things at play. I think that there is a general move towards consolidation that often happens when CFOs start to tighten their belt and they say, you've got a lot of overlap here. You've got a company over here who's doing something that this company over here actually says that they do as well. Why are we paying for two different softwares? Why are we paying for seats for all these different things? I saw recently someone describing the tech stack for sales and how it was $600 in yearly recurring fees per sales rep for this company, specifically because you layer on all of these different tools for different reasons that are bought over time. And you start to have this sort of go-to-market debt that is somewhat equivalent to technical debt, right? You make decisions along the way, you add things, and then you have to look and say, okay, how are we going to actually put this stuff together in a way that is meaningful. And I think that drives a lot of the conversations that happen where tech stacks appear and then they're broken up into a bunch of things and then they appear again. There's definitely benefits to best in class versus like a tech stack to rule them all. But it seems like we're in that we're in that market dynamic right now where people are saying we have a bunch of these tools. The best in class argument isn't really cutting it anymore because all the tools are doing very similar things. And the way to separate yourself from other vendors becomes much harder. And those vendors who are thinking about it long term and saying, like, how do we actually show our value if we are a point solution, so to speak? How do we make sure that what we are doing clearly is differentiated and we can weather this storm where folks are looking for places to cut out cost? Because obviously not every company can become some sort of behemoth ecosystem platform solution. But at the same time, you look at MarTech, there's 10,000 solutions that are trying to sell MarTech to a finite number of buyers. You think about these people, like, how are they ever going to make sense of this? So it ends up becoming much more of a who can brute force their way into existence. It's one of the easiest times to start a startup now because the cost of technology has dropped, but the friction that keeps the good from getting into a leading market position is as hard as it has ever been, if not the most hard it's ever been, simply because there's so much noise and it's very difficult to actually cut through that noise.
And what do you see as the big mistakes now and the problems in the sales and marketing of technology, SaaS, that need to change right now?
For me, it's infighting, right? Like, you, especially for earlier stage companies, but even larger companies, you don't need to wait for your competition to kill you if you commit suicide yourself. If you are going to fight against yourself internally while resisting any attempts to try to bring truth into the conversation, you're fighting with one arm behind your back. And any vendor out there that's actually consulting the market and talking to real prospects and understanding exactly what they care about are at a huge disadvantage because that infighting continues just as long as you're willing to allow people to have pet ideas and pet hypotheses that are never actually proven out one way or another. And it ends up being this inevitable marketing and sales fight of your leads are garbage or your sales team isn't executing. Most times it's somewhere in the middle if you're struggling, but if nobody's willing to shine a light at it and look at it objectively and open that kimono, you're going to be taking a lot of shots in the dark without really knowing what you're aiming at.
And I think this is a huge problem because I've talked to so many people and talked about their marketing. And when you start listening to it, it's just, oh my gosh, this, you're saying literally nothing. Or is this really a problem? And I think you and I both know why it happens because they're not looking at, they're just trying to come up with the answers themselves, aren't they?
Yeah, before I started my company, I've sat through a number of exercises where we've done differentiation, positioning, and messaging in a 2-hour meeting in a conference room, right? And these are for companies that are soon to IPO, post IPO, having this sort of bravado to think that you can just do this stuff on a whim. There's no wonder that sales teams don't trust marketing, right? There's a good reason for it. And they're used to being let down and they're used to being told, here's what you're going to do. Here's what you're going to sell. Here's how you're going to pitch it. We're going to certify you on it, telling the sales reps who actually interact with the market that we're going to be the judge of whether or not you're good enough at pitching this to go out and pitch it. And then if it falls flat, they're immediately going to abandon that message. They're going to go back to whatever they did, and you'll have no ability to say this is working or this is not working because you've got 100 sales reps doing their own thing, and there's no way to even track what is actually being successful or what is not.
I've been in those organizations and left, and I was just like, this is ridiculous because it was like stuff that just made no sense. And like you said, if the ship's sinking, the sales guy isn't going to stay on the ship and go, oh yeah, you've got, give me a cup. And they're going to start bailing themselves out with whatever they have.
Yeah. And they're the closest to the problem. So they are the canary in the coal mine, so to speak. They feel it And, you know, the number of marketing folks who don't even make the effort to go sit in on sales calls and actually have it bounce off them and get them to feel what's actually working or what's not. I'm a huge advocate for, before it ever gets to sales, that you've already tested it with buyers in an environment that allows them to be very critical and very honest with you. But at very least, you should be seeing how it's working in practice. If you wait until the point where you have to see it live in action, it's probably the worst time to test whether or not your weapons are working. But it's better than doing nothing and just saying, tell us how it goes, and we'll try to make adjustments to it. And the number of times I've seen this happen where they make, you aim at the wrong thing, you try it for a quarter, you try to change it in Q2, Q3, you try it again, but again, you didn't validate any of it. So now you're trying it again in third quarter, your fourth quarter, and it's Christmas again, and you've lost 2024 in this game of let's pretend we know what the customer wants.
It's amazing to me. And what's, when you go to these big companies, I'm just curious because I never saw it, but have you ever seen anyone in marketing go out to sales calls with a salesperson?
No, I hear about it. Like, I hear about people recommending it, right? But I think that marketers in general are a little afraid to find out what will happen, right? It's easy to sit in the ivory tower and say, tell me how it goes. I don't really want to be there for the pain of it if it doesn't go well. So I think that there's some sort of self-preservation where marketers say they want to do it, but between the deprioritization of it to go write another one pager or whatever, and just an overall uncomfortable nature around those sorts of sales environments. I came from a sales background.
Yeah.
Most product marketers, for instance, they're not sellers. They feel a little uncomfortable in those environments where there's a healthy tension in the room, right? Which keeps them on the sidelines and still making guesses.
And making guesses and not improving. That's we're developing some new products in house, and I'm like, and everyone's like, and I talked to other agency owners, and they're like, I'm going to go sit down, write this thing and do this thing and blah, blah. I'm like, no, go out, try to sell it to someone and listen to them. And if they don't, what they say, and they don't, like, I did this recently and people are like, I have no idea what you're talking about. I'm like, great. That's awesome. It hurts a little bit, but I've gotten to the point where I love to hear that because that saves you years of writing website copy that no one has any idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, you don't have to be right to go out and ask.
Like, no.
People think they got to refine, where really we find it best to go and ask really dumb questions, right? And actually state things as if they are fact. And you know what? The buyer is going to be the first one to tell you you're wrong. But the thing is, they're going to point you in the right direction. So you want that. You want them to say, you're dead wrong, man. That is not what you should be doing. Now, Steve Jobs famously talked about how a customer didn't know what they were looking for. But there's, from my perspective, it's not so much, I don't think the intent was to say, don't find out. It's, the intent was to say, don't go to your buyer and say, what should I build next?
No, yes.
That's a horrible idea. You should have a vision. But the fact of the matter is, that doesn't mean you don't consult them on your vision first. Because at the end of the day, their perspective is going to be what either sells or doesn't sell whatever you're trying to go to market with. And you can have the hubris of saying, we know better, or we're trying to be cutting leading edge company, so therefore our customer doesn't know what they want. You better nail it and be able to tell them what they want. But I don't think that precludes you from talking to them along the way. Even Steve Jobs famously said that, but I like to know what his consumer research department size was at the time. I guess it's pretty large, right? And he was getting information and he was learning from it. And then he would have the aha moments to say, these seemingly disparate data points, when combined together, lead me to an insight that I can actually take. Even Now, I tell people all the time, if you're going to talk to the buyer, you can actually do more harm than good if you go and just try to lead the witness, or if you just go to say, tell me I'm right.
Yeah.
So you got to be able to set your ego aside and say, tell me that I'm wrong. I don't want this. Even early stage companies, I think they fall into this habit of saying, I talked to my social circle and they said my idea is awesome.
Yeah.
Your grandma's going to tell you it's awesome and she's not your buyer anyway, right?
No.
So the last thing you want to do is find friendlies that are willing to tell you that you're awesome. One of the reasons why we exist is because companies of a certain size say, we want arm's length. We want somebody to be able to very comfortably tell us everything that's ugly about what we're doing. Doesn't mean you can't do it. And early stage, we recommend founders do it themselves. They need to really validate their market to start. They got to do some stuff that doesn't scale. And getting out there and having those conversations early stage is important. Now, the ones that survive because they did that customer development work tend to be, they survive, they grow, they become people managers, and then nobody takes up that effort after that. It becomes an abandoned effort. So then from that point on, everyone's viewpoint is what happened 3-4 years ago, right? When we actually did this the last time, but nobody's market is slow enough that you can rely on something that happened 3 or 4 years ago with early adopter buyers when now you're trying to sell to mainstream.
Yeah. And I've seen that so much in software. I'm like, why has this software not changed in 3 years? And we've adapted. We know how to do things different. And I want this and this. But to your point, I think about that. I don't know how true it is, but in the movie Steve Jobs, where he's watching his actual daughter. He was arguing if it was his daughter or whatever. And he watched her use it. And he's like, oh my God, it comes to a realization. And if you really listen to him, he was all about watching people and what they did and how they did. And everyone told him to keep the keyboard, but he really watched how people use stuff. Right. And he's, that's what people want and what they really wanted. And so really listening to them and the conflict is so important. And I love that piece about the conflict because I'm reading Adam Grant's new book. And he talks about the fastest growth comes through going for the most discomfort and figuring out what's wrong as fast as possible. Yeah. So I want to get into what's your process? Because this is all genius fundamental stuff.
Right.
It's the most important stuff that people can do, especially if you're going to go spend $100 million on advertising. Know what people want. I don't know. That's. But so explain to me how you all do this.
Yeah. And to your point, it's one of the cheapest insurance policies that you can buy as far as making an investment in this, whether in-house or with a partner, to de-risk these decisions. I'm upfront in saying most of the time people buy us not because they are trying to be they're not looking for advantage necessarily as much as they have a healthy fear. What if we're wrong? What if we didn't do this? So to that end, a lot of our work starts with the hypothesis, right? What do you believe to be true? It's an effort to add some scientific rigor. Even in our case, we don't work with companies that are necessarily selling to consumer and can have statistical significance, but you can have 20 conversations with ICPs in your market and you can start to connect dots about what you need to do. So what we specifically focus on is that persona. First of all, do you understand this person intimately? And I've seen so many personas that are written. They came traditionally from consumer where it's somebody's 45, they drive a Volvo, they're a soccer mom. It doesn't help in B2B. So for us in our world, it has to be way more about their motivations, their intentions, what inhibits what are their brakes and accelerators, right? To whether or not they actually hand the business to one vendor or another. What do they actually care about right now? Personas oftentimes get stale super quick because people are like, we did personas 2 years ago. 2 years ago, my guess is they had an entirely different strategy, and that colors the entire way that they think about what they're going to invest in. So focusing really heavily on that, focusing really heavily on how people want to buy, how they want to be talked to. The goal for me with the persona work is really to have someone say, when a sales rep comes and pitches to them, that that you're the one vendor that they say, those guys get me, right? They're the ones that get me, because the fastest way to their heart is for them to say they understand my struggle. And it's not some sort of effort to try to manufacture an understanding of their struggle, right? Every sales rep is taught to go in, do a needs analysis, learn what you can about their struggle. But if you don't actually really understand like their day-to-day and have the ability to empathize with the problems they have, it sounds cold and clinical and not all that interesting to them, even if you can recite back to them the exact things that they told you. So the persona is super important to me. Differentiation is extremely important. It's the foundation by which you should build your position and message, which is really about saying, not what are we good at. What are we good at doesn't matter to anyone except your mom. Like, it's, you can be, we have this happen all the time. Clients who are very good at some stuff that the buyer couldn't care less about. Right. Hmm. And it's a really hard message for us to have to deliver, but I'm committed to delivering that to clients. If I have to come back to them and say, you know what, the five things that you think your buyer really cares about and you're the best at, your buyer doesn't care at all. Like, you have to rethink who you are, because the buyer has told us, we don't care. We don't care about any of that stuff. We actually care about this other stuff. So when we do differentiation, it's also a view of not just what does the buyer care about that you think you can differentiate yourself in, but what are the alternative places that other vendors in the market are using to differentiate themselves. Stack rank them, have them teach you why they've ranked them the way they have, what is important about the different things that they've been told. And then you can come back and really have a conversation about what are the things that we really want to differentiate ourselves in, but it's too aspirational. People aren't buying the message, or they won't buy the message because we're not really there. And the number of companies that do this is off the charts. Number of companies that want to pitch a huge vision, but they're not there yet. Like,
yeah. Most
investors love that stuff. Buyers probably don't care all that much unless you can really tell them, what can I do for you today? And this is what it's going to look like tomorrow. That's a different story. But that differentiation is really about helping them determine what is actually unique about what they do, durable over time, something that's not going to, a competitor can't come and swipe out from underneath you in a quarter's time and some code. Can you actually prove that is something that is truly differentiated about you with metrics that the buyer actually trusts, right? Yeah. If you're selling to a scientist, it's going to be an entirely different set of metrics that you need and rigor you need compared to if you're selling to a plumber, right? And then finally, the buyer has to answer the question of value. You can guess all you want, but unless you have a conversation where the buyer actually shares their true ranking of how they actually think of value and what you're doing and what the rest of the market is doing, you're going to be making up a whole lot of stuff. And then finally, I've covered a lot here, but having those conversations on the back end with around loss, where you're uncovering not just why did you choose one or another, but you're refining your persona, you're learning about your market, your competition, all the different ways that you can change your go-to-market to help you be successful. I think marketers think, and even a lot of sales folks think of that as like win-loss is a sales thing. Tell them what they're doing wrong.
Yeah.
It's rare that we come back and we just, all the feedback we have is sales messed all this up, right? There's something for marketing to do. There's something for product to do. There's something for the strategy team to do. I don't actually like win-loss used in the context it often is, which is, let's go tell sales how to change how they're selling. Sales is most likely selling the way they've been told to sell. And it's a holistic problem that executives need to be involved in making changes on the scale by which you'll actually move the needle if you actually make the change. So all this sort of wraps up into, are you talking to the market? Are you talking to the buyer? Are you talking to the right people? And are you asking the right questions? It's not about going and like doing a live questionnaire with these people, or here's question one, let's move to question two. It's how can you be so curious that people can feel how curious you are and want to divulge a bunch, because you're there to talk shop with them and learn everything you can about them. Buyers actually love that, right? If a buyer can be told, look, we want to be the one vendor that when we show up next time you need to buy something like this, you're like, they built what I wanted. That's a great value proposition for a buyer and market to be like, you're going to have one vendor at least that took your feedback and applied it. Now let's go build something together.
Yeah, I love that. And it is when it has that magic too, of if you adjust based on what they said, now they're some of your biggest proponents too, aren't they?
Absolutely. It's huge. And it's not a question of, there's a lot of feedback loops for customers and others in market where, yeah, they can fill out a survey and tell you how you did, but the nuance isn't there. Or even, I'm a huge proponent of using things like Gong to go back and try to look and see what you can improve, but you're not going to get the kind of nuance or the ability to match up all the different disparate points of feedback into something that creates a strategy that you can actually execute on.
And just to finish up, can you give me an example of a company that you walked in and was doing it wrong? You did this and it transformed the company.
Yeah, I'll give you one good example. It's specific to Win-Loss, but they've used us for other things as well. We've been involved in their differentiation, et cetera. But one good example of this, Modernizing Medicine, or ModMed, by what they go by, 1,500 person company. They were doing very well, right? It's not like they were circling the drain. They're doing very well as a company. What they focus on is software for specialist physicians, right? And we were introduced to them, sold them on the idea that they had to get a Win-Loss program in place. And very shortly after us starting this Win-Loss program, their win rates shot up over 10 percentage points. Think about in any scenario, whether that's going from 30% to 40% win or 40 to 50, like, it's a multi-million dollar difference in the business by executing on one thing. Now, we've helped them with everything from positioning, messaging, how they talk about themselves in market. But just one of those things creates a huge value that in a company of really any size, executing in the right way. Now, to be honest, like I've said, there are wrong ways to go about this stuff. And from my perspective, if you're not going to use this strategically and you're going to use it to come down on sales reps or tell people they need to fix this and that without actually doing it systemically, you're not going to get that kind of result. But if you're committed to actually making changes to conform with what the market wants from you, there's millions and millions of dollars to be had, and it becomes an incredible ROI for companies that go and do this sort of thing. On the side of capturing buyer feedback before you actually go to market, that is also really incalculable in the cost of when we go out and do this and they nail the pitch the first time. If you got 50, if you got any more than 10 sales reps, the cost to have them out in market pitching something that's wrong is not just the cost of losing deals that you wanted to win, but it's the cost of also not pursuing deals because you have sunk your time into stuff that's not actually working. Like I said, it is a bit of an insurance policy, but at the same time, there is a way to think about this and be proactive as well and see really big results. It's not just a what if we didn't do this, although that's a huge number. But the great news is there's a calculable and real effect on the top line growth, on the churn rate by doing this sort of thing.
Yeah. And to your point, it's now becoming, it's not just, oh, you get 10 points better on closing sales. It is going to be, these types of things are going to be the ones that probably differentiate companies that survive and companies that die, because there's just so many of them.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're taking 1 in 3, 1 in 4 wins that you weren't before, you're taking it from somewhere, right?
Yeah.
And you're taking it from other alternatives that were available to them. To tie this back to the sort of original conversation that we were having, I do think that especially in the venture capital software world, or private equity owned software world, there are going to be a bunch of vendors that are left out to dry because they're just written off as bad investments. The time when, you know, money costs $0 to borrow and it was just flooded in market at some of the worst ideas ever, that's come and gone. Like, now you have to prove yourself. You can't raise $250 million+ on an idea that is a lark, or you're not well positioned to win in that market. I think that a lot of companies have to start thinking about this, because the alternative is, like, you have middling results and nobody wants to fund your next round, right? They're going to start cutting bait and saying some of these investments aren't going to pay out, but we're not going to throw money at them based on a promise that maybe you'll get there eventually. And it's going to be their expense, but the people who are out there doing the work to validate this stuff and frankly get sales and marketing rowing in the right direction, not having this internal civil war where they fight against each other. There's no way to win against the external market if you are just constantly the recipient of friendly fire.
Yes. No, it's a huge problem. It's a huge problem, and it can be solved by really focusing on the customer.
Yeah.
And doing it having a methodology. So if someone wants to hire you, tell us a little bit about working with you all.
Yeah. Feel free to go to our website, aggregateinsights.com. We focus really heavily on the things that we talked about today, but every engagement with us is a bit bespoke because everyone's different and they've got different needs. We love working with companies that want to turn the corner and start consulting the market. You'll see great results if you do.
Nice. Yeah, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes. If you go to aggregateinsights.com/podcast, tell us a little bit of what you got there.
Yeah, so we do have an ungated resource for you. I'm of the opinion, my point of view is that what the type of work that we do is not a secret. It's not a special sauce. It's hard. And having people who have the muscle memory from doing it every day is helpful. That's how we earn our business every day. But we're very open with everyone about how we do it, all the way down to the nitty gritty of, like, how are you going to execute these sorts of things. So we do have a guide around how to build a win-loss program that's on that page. Feel free to grab it. Like I said, it's ungated. It's yours to keep, yours to execute on. It's really hard won information from us doing this for 5 years now of how to do it best. And yeah, happy to offer that to everyone. And if anyone does have any interest in having a conversation with us about how we can step it up a notch, then feel free to get in touch.
Awesome. We'll put a link to all that in the show notes and your LinkedIn. That's pretty, from what I understand, that's where you're most active. So I'll put a link to all that. Brady, thank you so much for being on the Garlic Marketing Show. This was an awesome conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was a great conversation.
Awesome. And thank you all for taking Brady and I on your journey. This has been I and Garlic and the Garlic Marketing Show. Video. You know it'll make you an authority. You know it will get you more leads, better leads that close faster and spend more with you. And video stories will help you be remembered and connect with those perfect clients. The problem is, where do you start?
StoryCruise.com is the place to go. It's like a film crew with an S. What's your strategy? Do you do it yourself? Do you hire a videographer, an agency? Do you need an editor? How do you know if they really know your business and how to make videos for business that work? The answer to all of this and more can be found at StoryCruise.com. It is the place to find the latest video marketing strategies, the best gear for your business, as well as videographers, editors, and agencies near you that are trained in video storytelling for business. Go to StoryCruise.com/garlic to get special insider info for listeners of the Garlic Marketing Show, including special access to several of my courses, including my case story course. Go to StoryCruise.com/garlic to get a whole bunch of special offers just for listeners of the Garlic Marketing Show. Whether you're looking for a videographer or to do it yourself, go to StoryCruise.com/garlic to get started today.
That's it for the Garlic Marketing Show. If you want to get the inside scoop and the latest techniques, make sure to follow I and Garlic on Facebook.